Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
If you're familiar with the program, you know that after that kind of big music comes something really big. So joining me today is an author, Lieutenant Colonel Thad Drake, Jr. He is the first place winner of the Major General Harold Chase Essay Contest. And he's an infantry officer. And Thad, first of all, welcome to All Marine Radio. Thanks for doing this.
Here.
All right, before we talk about what you wrote, which is entitled The Fantasy of MCDP-1, which, as you're perusing, you know, titles of stuff, immediately catches your eye, right? Well, that ought to be an interesting read. We have to find out about you. So let's talk about you. Born and raised where?
Born in South Carolina, raised mostly in Tallahassee, Florida for the majority of my life, but it's been a while since I've lived there at this point.
Got it. How does the Marine Corps, first of all, what is Tallahassee famous for, if you call that home? What is
the best thing coming out of Tallahassee, other than being the state capital, is it's got to be the Florida State Seminoles, although they're not doing so well this year.
Are you a graduate of that August University?
No, I'm not. I went to the Naval Academy, but I grew up in the good years of the Seminoles through the late 80s and into the 90s. So I spent some time watching them win football games.
They were pretty good. All right. So that's Tallahassee's claim to fame. Talk to us. How does obviously the Naval Academy, and let's talk about the Naval Academy. How does the Naval Academy get on your radar as a young human being? That's not the path normally taken by most of us.
Yeah, that's a great question. My parents will tell you that I started talking about the Naval Academy when I was an elementary schooler. I don't have a good answer as to why that was. Apparently, I'm a part of a military family, and I didn't know it, I guess.
So who in your family was in the military?
Kind of the standard grandparents who fought in World War II, an uncle on my mother's side, an uncle on my father's side. But, you know, I didn't spend a lot of time around the military growing up or anything like that.
All right. So your dad, not a veteran, or your mom, or, nope, or anything like that. But like a lot of people grew up looking at the pictures at grandma and grandpa's house.
Oh, sure.
Your grandfather in what branch of the service?
He was a Marine. He was a captain, I believe, but he spent most of World War II shooting anti-aircraft guns off the front of the USS Langley.
Nice, nice. How did they control their fires? You know, when you watch those videos of the Japanese kamikazes as they come to the ship and you see shit going everywhere, and then you start thinking, did they have fields of fire that they would not shoot an adjacent warship, or did they light each other up all the time?
But I think they lit each other up fairly regularly. It's completely aside. I was reading a recent book on Civic War, Ian Toll's book that just came out, and
Hold on. Let me ask you. I know two people that have cracked that thing, and they both are out of their minds about how good the book is. Your preliminary thoughts on it?
Yeah, I've read the whole trilogy. I loved every word of it. I think it's really, really good.
Got it. All right.
Yeah. So anyway, he's got just an aside in there that says when they found out about VE Day, and then towards the end of the war, that, you know, some ungodly number of sailors were killed by falling anti-aircraft bullets as they were shooting their guns into the sky for celebration.
How stupid, right? How stupid. Yeah. But I mean, stuff that, you know, I can remember, I think it was in 2004, the Iraqi national soccer team played its first game in I don't know how long, and I think they beat somebody, and all of a sudden, spontaneously in the evening, like, there is gunfire from everywhere, and it's them celebrating, and then you're medevacking people for getting wounded and stuff like that. Nothing aimed at anybody, just a stupid celebration. So you grow up as a kid, you know, you have a Naval Academy fetish. I did too. I wrote a paper about the Naval Academy in fifth grade, but it never actually occurred to me that I could go there. So you wind up going there. You go there. Your grandpa's a Marine. Was it in your mind when you went to become a Marine, or were you fairly open to the ideas of becoming an officer in the United States Navy?
No, I had Marine Corps written all over me from the day I got there.
Really? You're that kid?
Yeah, I was. I was probably insufferable.
All right, so you graduate Naval Academy, you join the Marine Corps. What do you become? Did you want to be an infantry officer from the start, or?
I wanted to be an infantry officer from the time I said I was going to be in the Marine Corps, or from the time at least I knew what an infantry officer was. So I just ended up one of the lucky ones coming out of the basic school and ended up in the grunts.
Got it. All right. Give us a 90-second synopsis of your career.
So I ended up in 2nd Battalion, 6th Marines as a lieutenant, and I stayed there for about not quite 3 years. Spent time as a, you know, the standard lieutenant package, rifle platoon commander, weapons platoon commander, XO, company XO. Did a deployment to Baghdad in 2004, and then a deployment right outside Fallujah in 2005. Got back, went to the basic school and taught there, kind of in a host of different positions, mostly in the heavy weapons, machine guns type side. Ended up at IOC for about 3-ish years. Then I went to school for a year, ended up in 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines as a company commander, and deployed to Afghanistan with Golf Company up in Musakala, Northern Helmand Province, or Mid Helmand Province, I suppose. Came back and then went with Weapons Company 2-4 on the 31st MU. Spent some time as the officer there as well. And then I went to school again, the command and staff, and then the School of Advanced Warfighting. After graduating from the School of Advanced Warfighting, I headed out to Bahrain, out in SINCOM. And I spent 2 years as a planner on what initially was the 5th Med staff, and then it became the Task Force 515 staff, a mix of 5th Med and a Naval Amphibious Task Force, Task Force 51. I spent some time on that and then made my way out to Okinawa. I was the operations officer for the 3rd Reconnaissance Battalion and then the future operations officer and operations officer and XO over a course of a year for 4th Marine Regiment. And then I made my way out here in Detroit, Michigan, where I'm the inspector instructor for 1st Battalion, 24th Marines.
Do you know Colonel Kevin Norton?
Yeah, he and I. We weren't in 4th Marines at the same time, but we certainly bounced into each other plenty. He was the chief of staff at 3rd MARTIV when I was at 3rd Recon and 4th Marines.
Right. No, I've crossed paths with him a number of times. All right, give me you can only select one. Somebody who's been a huge influence in your Marine Corps career.
Oh man, that's tough.
There's
so many. Only one.
I know.
I'm gonna go with now retired Colonel Bill Vivian. He was my battalion commander in 2-4 when we went to Afghanistan. He and I still talk plenty.
Got it. Give me one book if you were to tell people to read it. This is the book they should read.
Oh, man, that's a hard one.
Hey, I told you this was not going to be easy, okay?
Yeah, you could have given me a heads up that I was going to have to pick one book. I don't know what to do about
it. One book to tell people to read, what would it be?
I think... My answer to that used to be Fields of Fire. I loved Fields of Fire my entire growing up time. I think I've changed over now, and it's Matterhorn.
Really? He's an interesting guy. I've interviewed him a few times, and him talking about writing the book, and just his whole experience as a Rhodes Scholar, and then as a lieutenant, and he's an interesting guy, Carl Marlanis. Mine is This Kind of War by Fehrenbach.
I love This Kind of War.
Yeah, no, his writing is he's a great writer, and you know, I think it summons the Marine Corps' greatness in terms of, you know, the greater level of discipline that the Marine Corps tends to embrace, and my favorite. All right, let's talk about this article, The Fantasy of MCDP. So you're right off the did you write the headline, or did some the headline writer at the Gazette write that?
So I wrote the title.
So you're a subheading. So you're a blasphemer right off the shoot. Right off the shoot, right?
I mean, maybe
blasphemer. I can hear it being screamed right now. Blasphemer. Where does the idea, normally these ideas roll around in our heads when we write for a while before we actually articulate them, and then there's a whole process of sitting down and composing it so somebody else might get what we're saying at the end of reading a few pages. Where does this article start in your head?
So I think this probably starts mostly during my time at command and staff and the School of Advanced Warfighting. For whatever reason, I ended up in some electives there and having some conversations while I was in those two schools that drove me towards just asking myself the question, particularly, you know, as you look at the kind of the sub elements of the article, talking about systems theory and some of the other stuff that we will talk, I'm sure we'll get into, you know, just kind of asking myself, you know, is what we say we're doing really what we're doing, or is what we say we should be doing really what we're doing? And if not, was it ever what we were doing? And it drove me towards asking some harder questions of myself and some of the folks that I was in school with, I suppose.
Got it. The disconnect between what we tend to say and then ultimately what we do. So in spite of your blasphemous title, the article itself is not that blasphemous, just so everybody knows. So let's talk about it. Give me the major premises of the article.
So I'd say there's probably kind of one overarching premise and then a couple subordinate points to it. The overarching premise of the whole thing is maybe trying to see the world as it is rather than as we wish it would be, or you know, the aspirational doctrine versus an actual practical doctrine that articulates the way we actually fight. And so the crux of the article is trying to grapple with that to some degree or another. You know, are we just saying we ought to do something that we know that we probably never will? And then as we dive deeper into the article, it starts to look at a couple key areas that probably need updating within the kind of the umbrella of that. The previous point with, you know, the discussion of the systemic collapse and mission tactics are kind of the two points that I call out that I would really like to look at. But, you know, overall, the thing that the question that I ask myself the whole time is just, you know, it's been 30 years, a little more than 30 years since we put this doctrine in place. Where do we have clear evidence that we've gotten there? And if not, you know, at what point do we stop saying we need to get there?
And when, where is there?
To actually executing what the doctrine says we should do.
Okay, this whole concept of maneuver warfare, mission orders, you know, what's really interesting, again, because we were talking before we started recording, you know, my experience of being in Quantico and participating in these discussions, you know, the Marine Corps before this, I don't even know that we had a warfighting doctrine. I mean, not that it was articulated to me. We had our, you know, the FMFM 6-4, which I believe, if I remember, was company, you know, company operations. The 6-5 was squad operations. And so I don't know of any, I mean, critics of the way the Marine Corps fought would have called it our attrition style of warfare. Those who participated would have called it the style of warfare that wins wars. And so that would go. So when it was, and I remember PME General Zinni did, and he said, you know, what reality calls for is quick decisions, elastic tactics, and the ability to operate, you know, when communication is restrained, if not eliminated. So in my recollection, now that as I think of the discussions, that is what maneuver warfare and then ultimately FMFM1 and then MCDP1 ultimately tried to address. Did they fail? And let me ask you a two-part question. One, did they fail, right? And do you think the Marine Corps, in particular the officer corps of the Marine Corps, has embraced it as a warfighting philosophy?
I think you could say that we have incompletely done many of the things that the book says we should do. You know, as a broad warfighting philosophy, or if we use what General Zenny said, you know, elastic tactics, flexibility on the battlefield, those sorts of things, I think the Marine Corps has always probably been pretty good about that. There are obviously counter arguments, you know, the Marines on Peleliu kind of beating their head against entrenched Japanese positions. Although I don't know that there was a lot of options other than that, you know, right. Or Okinawa, you know, I don't know that there were a lot of options beyond just kind of frontal assaults. Although I'm sure the folks on the deck probably tried a whole lot of other options. So if that's what we mean, if we mean flexibility in the battlefield, elastic tactics, a willingness to try new things, I think the Marine Corps has done some of that. Although I don't know that, and I wasn't around in the late 80s, I don't know that MCDP-1 was necessarily the catalyst there. I would say there are a lot of specifics in MCDP-1 that we say that we ought to do that we definitely don't. And I think most Marine officers, most Marines in general, would read through the book and they find it easy to highlight lots of things that we say we should do that we just don't.
All right, give me an example. And I want you, in our experience, right, is that from the MEF on down, if I choose to, I can click into your Merc chat window and watch you operate, right? I can impose on you a system where, because you're using an aviation asset, I need your squad conop at the MEF and MA level. We live in a system that, where for the last 20 years, those are the things that have happened. That's the command and control system. So have we even done maneuver warfare in the last 20 years, in your opinion?
I think there are arguments that we've probably done maneuver warfare based on people's understanding of the doctrine, particularly the systems collapse stuff. You know, there's before we even get into that, I mean, there are plenty of examples. Just I'm flipping through my MCDP-1 as we're sitting here. So I'm trying to find some of the quotes that I've highlighted where, you know, we suggest that there are certain things that we ought to do regardless of the type of warfare we're fighting that would help our organization set up a philosophy of command that supports maneuver warfare. We say things like we should establish long-term working relationships, developing familiarity and trust for maneuver warfare and mission command. Well, I don't know what your experience is with the Marine Corps, but I've not seen these long-term working relationships. We rotate people in and out.
Don't have them. That's a lie.
Yearly. Yeah, I mean, it just
That's
doesn't exist.
Right, it doesn't exist.
People can highlight the pub, and they can see that it's in there, and that clearly starts to build some distaste.
Unless you define long term as more than like 6 weeks, that's a fail on that. One of the things I thought was interesting in your paper, you highlight why, you know, some of the cultural reasons why these things don't happen, but you illustrate why it did happen for the Germans. Can you footnote that? Explain why did it happen for the Germans?
And I'll caveat, I was arguing with someone just this morning about the Wehrmacht and the Germans. And yeah, the Germans, they obviously had tactical excellence, maybe operational excellence, if we want to talk about it that way, certainly strategic failure. And they of course, they lost the war. But there is, I would say, generally speaking, there's a recognition across the military that the Germans were very capable, for what it's worth. You know what? You talk about a lot of the scholarship, Van Krevel's fighting power and stuff like that. And there's clearly a recognition that they were man for man and unit for unit, probably more capable than ours were. Why is that? Well, you know, I mentioned the Germans, they were spending 10 to 12 years in the same unit before World War II. And that just builds a kind of trust and a kind of knowledge of each other that we can't replicate, no matter how much we pressurize that system or try to speed it up. It is very difficult to build the kind of trust that you would have after knowing and associating with someone on a day-to-day basis for 12 years straight. I don't know that we have a system, we could build a system that would allow for that sort of thing, at least not in our current environment.
Right. So again, I thought that was an interesting point, but I agree with you. Talk to me about, so in terms of manpower, we don't do that. What about, do we actually practice? Because I mean, I'll give you real world experiences in regimental combat, COCs in Fallujah and in Helmand, having to field phone calls from people higher than the division level, who are watching a video feed or watching a Merc chat conversation, calling down to say, "Hey, tell them to," and then saying, "Hey, sir, they've got a commanding officer. He's a lieutenant colonel just like you. So I know you think you know what's going on, but you know, it's okay if you want to be a voyeur in that window. Don't ever call down here again, though," which is a moderately awkward conversation, right? But I mean, and I would say, because I was older and more experienced, I wasn't afraid to have that. And then to go tell the regimental CO, "Hey, the next time you see Lieutenant Colonel so-and-so, will you throw up and in on him?" I'd be delighted to, right? I'd be delighted to. And then you never heard from the guy again. But there is that 8,000-foot screwdriver out there. So in your opinion, do we even practice it when we go to war?
I think, you know,
you can say no. Don't be afraid. Because let me tell you, I don't think we do. We say it. We don't do it, though.
So, I'll say, in my experience, I've had the experience that you just mentioned for sure. But I've also had the experience of quality leaders. I mentioned Colonel Bill Vivian.
Right.
When we were in Afghanistan. He did everything he could to insulate me as a company commander and my subordinate platoon commanders from exactly that. And I think he did a pretty good job,
but
for the most part.
But the system, I'm not talking about individuals, but the system overall, right? First of all, I don't know how many, you know, Marine officers truly embrace it, truly read it, and would call themselves, you know, I'm pretty well studied in this stuff. I understand it. And I know what I've got to do for you. Now, there's going to be times when I have to lean on you and give you more. That's my prerogative as a commanding officer. But, and there's going to be also times when I leave you alone. I don't know that we're there yet. And so, to me, when you go to play, you bet your life for real. My experience is that we do not practice it so much. It is aspirational in nature. I think the biggest thing that FMFM1 and then MCDP1 did was it fostered more education among officers, and I think that's a good thing. But in terms of practicing it, I told you this before we came on, but I don't recall hearing very often, "Yeah, what dilemma are we placing him with this course of action?" Or even as the course of actions are brief, "Here's the course of action, here's his dilemma." I don't recall ever hearing that. And the times I asked about it, I got looked at and said, "Quit being a dick, Mac." Like, look, we all know, like, you're an IOC, you're a published writer and all that bullshit, right? You know, we're doing real world stuff. Oh, really? Got it. Sorry about that. So do we practice it?
Yeah, I mean, I think you make a good point. And as we're, you know, you're talking about the 8,000-mile screwdriver, one of the points that I kind of start to get into in the mission tactics piece of it, where I think it's just a flaw in our doctrine where we say we're going to execute mission tactics. Part of the problem is the discipline required of higher headquarters and commanders at all echelons to not pick up the phone or pick up the radio or pick up the text message or whatever system we're using and get into their subordinates' business. It takes an unbelievable amount of discipline not to do that, particularly now on a day-to-day basis when we're used to being able to do that all the time. And I'm personally concerned that you know, this, the culture of society, you know, we're kind of a lagging indicator. The culture of society is leading us this direction where everybody's used to immediate communications with everyone else all the time. And I'm not sure how you back away from that.
All right. What about when it's imposed on you? Because another Zinni quote, "The reason why I've got to communicate intent, because somebody might be somewhere, right, doing something really important, and let me fast forward to someday in the South China Sea. Our digital comm has been compromised because our satellites have been nudged, right? Any relay station that lights off, you know, gets rocketed within 90 seconds. And so we are operating, with a few exceptions, nose cold. And now this situation has changed and somebody's got to make a decision. I don't think that's out of the realm of possibilities. So how, you know, so what say ye about that in terms of mission tactics? Our culture is always one of, you know, being instant communication, but the environment in which we might find ourselves in might not allow for that. And I think all you have to do is look at the 2nd Marine Division's large scale exercise and some of the lessons they learned in terms of, you know, once you light off the electronic spectrum and your survivability.
Yeah, I think I have a couple thoughts on that. The first is I think it's still an open question. It's the easy answer. It's not easy to fight that way. I mean, 2nd Mardiv, right, and Tuna and the LSE obviously experienced that, at least in training. But I think it's simpler for us to just say, well, everything's going to be turned off on the battlefield, than to recognize that may not be entirely the case. I mean, you know, you see examples from China, for example, with some of the early Hong Kong protests where the internet's turned off and the phone networks are turned off, yet somehow they're still networking using Bluetooth and mesh networking apps and stuff like that. So I think the idea of the dark battlefield is a seductive one because it forces us back into thinking about the mission command, mission tactics thing.
Right.
I'm not sure that we're living in reality to just say, well, I mean, we'll be out in the middle of the desert and everything's going to be turned off. I think that's a little bit glib.
Okay, so what? So does your command and control system have to provide for that, or does it suffice to say, yeah, I don't think that'll ever happen, so we don't provide for that eventuality? And
no,
and,
I mean, and obviously you gotta train for the worst, and you hope the worst isn't going to happen. But I think we have to think through it more. We've got to be a little bit more nuanced than just saying, well, everything's going to get turned off, because that leads us back into this whole say-do gap that we run into in every single day of every single Marine's life. And it's just, it's corrosive.
Okay. All right. And I think that's, and we've illustrated some of the things. We say maneuver warfare, we say mission tactics, we say commander's intent, and then everybody's watching your Merc chat window. They're whispering to you, you know, which is a person-to-person message. And we have the ability electronically to micromanage in ways we've never even considered, right? And Howland Mad Smith would maybe get very animated that he could actually exert more control, or maybe not. I don't know how he would react. We have that capability, and we live that way in our culture. I want you to wax eloquent on a couple of things. You take issue with the whole idea of systemic collapse, and as the aim of maneuver warfare and MCDP-1. Talk about that and your criticism of it.
Yeah. So. I'm not inherently opposed to the idea of collapsing the enemy system as kind of Boyd described it and John Schmidt wrote it into warfighting. I think and lots of Marines don't even really think about that. So I'll stipulate that up front. I think though, for the folks who do think a lot about it, it's become exactly that. It's become the aim, without a lot of deep thinking beyond that. You know, what next? What comes after that? I'd suggest a couple things there. One, it's a way, not an ultimate aim, right? We collapse the system to do what? But beyond that, you know, I wrote a little bit in the piece. The question I keep asking myself is, we've had this doctrine for 30 years, which is significantly longer than any doctrine of a Western nation that I can think of. I can't think of another doctrine that lasted that long. You know, the French after World War I maybe lasted until, well, the beginning of World War II. That's about 20 years. I'm trying to think hard about another kind of capstone doctrine that lasted any lengthy time, and I think ours has probably lasted the longest. So in that time, most of which we've been at war, we should be able to show a clear example of systemic collapse actually doing what we say it's going to do, and you know, winning the day. I wrote in the piece, I had a really hard time finding that.
All right, so and let me, I'll tee them up, and you can hit them. Desert Storm. I mean, you know, the Iraqi army, the Iraqi military, you know, got routed in Kuwait. Was that not systemic collapse?
Yeah, I think you can make a case that we did in fact collapse the system, but as I was saying, you know, it's kind of a way, not an ultimate end, because as we collapse the system, and it all, obviously there's lots of interpretations of kind of the way Desert Storm went down.
Right.
But in many interpretations, as the Marine Corps pushes into the obstacle belt or through the obstacle belt and collapses the system, it does exactly the opposite of what we were tasked to do, which was fix the Iraqi army to allow the big left hook.
So, but at that point, were the Marine Corps and our doctrine, I mean, aren't we a piece of this much larger puzzle, and that our piece is allowing the army the freedom of movement to do what they're going to do, which is the left hook, right? So ultimately, are we not faithful to our own doctrine, even though our piece in it is pretty attritionistic? I think I just made a word up.
Yeah, it's a great word, but I think that's exactly the question. If we're supposed to fight frontally and fix the folks that we're fighting, but instead shatter their system and make them retreat before they're supposed to, that may be a problem.
Well, I don't see it as a problem. I see it as this is our role in this ripping apart their system, and we're the fixers. I would submit to you, I mean, you probably led some, you know, patrols in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, your job was to go find the enemy, and once found, fix them so we could eliminate them from the planet. And
yeah, absolutely. Right? I'm all about the fix mission. I think it's a useful mission.
Right.
But arguably that's not what we did. We did, because our doctrine told us to rupture the system and disintegrate it. We did rupture the system and disintegrate it. And in fact, didn't fix that portion of the Iraqi army. They instead broke and ran and retreated, and we didn't manage to encircle them with the army's left hook.
Got it. So is it the choice of technique in terms of the penetration and our ability to close with and fix the enemy that you would quarrel with, or the doctrine, the warfighting doctrine that spawned that whole evolution?
So I obviously I'm far too young to have been a part of the Desert Storm planning or execution. I'd say that.
Hold on. Far too young? You're not that far too young, okay?
Well, yeah, I'm not as far as I'd like to be.
All right. Go ahead.
I guess I'd say that when you're told to attack, you attack, of course.
Right.
The MEF attacked as it knew how, and it had catastrophic success that then had ripple effects into the Joint Force Commander's scheme maneuver. I think potentially if our doctrine had said something else, not that we're going after systemic collapse as our ultimate aim all the time, potentially we could have looked at that with some more nuance.
So is that the problem, your problem with systemic collapse, in that? Because, I mean, another thing I heard General Zinni say, and he said, hey, look, I don't hate attrition. I like attrition. Steel on target, that's good shit, right? He said, so I don't see it as an either-or proposition. To me, it sounds like you're saying something similar.
I'm absolutely saying something similar. And MCDP-1, and the way it was written to its credit, puts attrition and maneuver on a spectrum. It does not suggest that there aren't elements of both of those things in everything we do. But I would suggest that most Marines that I've – not most, many Marines I've interacted with – simplify it. We Americans love our dichotomies.
Right.
You're either with me or against me sort of thing. Like, it's good or it's evil. And I think a lot of Marines do that with the maneuver attrition problem, where it's either maneuver or it's attrition. You know, we saw that in the attrition papers a few years ago in the Gazette, where we built this caricature of an attritionist, but I'm not sure that that's a useful way to look at it.
No, I'll tell you what, it's absolutely not. And when you hear a guy like Zinni, I used to call, so I'm an instructor. I actually, leaving what was known as tactics at the base of school and getting ready to go to be an instructor at infantry officer course. John Kelly's the group chief. Lou Caparata is one of my peers. Jody Osterman's another one. Stacy Clarity, all 3-star generals. And they weren't that smart, by the way. right. And they know that too. But anyway, I see him as we're going out to do, I don't know, long range patrols. And so I've got my group of lieutenants and I see John Kelly and he says, "Hey, Max, you're going to go see General Zinni speak tonight." And when you're at the basic school, there's people always coming through to speak. And I said, "I don't know him, sir. Should I go? Or is this going to be a waste of my time?" He said, "No, go." So Zinni was, in my opinion, the first really substantive guy that I heard. And I've since taken to calling him the burning bush. Because he said this. He goes, "Look, man, I love attrition. Steal on target." And he said, "Why am I going to move somebody to kill somebody when I can kill them? You know, the attritionist way with Artie." He said, "I shot a TOT of like 600 rounds on their ass one day. That was good. I like attrition. It's not a bad thing." So I've always, I agree with you that whole, you know, like one is good and the other is bad. The only thing that makes, in my opinion, a technique or a warfighting, you know, doctrine or philosophy good or bad is the misapplication of that into situations that it doesn't apply. And then we grab it by the throat and then we stuff it down, you know, somebody's throat and we say, "There, we're maneuverist." And it's like, "Yo, bro, you could have fired a regimental TOT and not done any of that. And you still have 70 guys that were not wounded and killed."
Sure.
Oh, my bad. So to me, no, I think that's absolutely valid, is that we see this as this either or argument as opposed to existing. And I'll tell you what, I used to, when I taught a decision making class at IOC, I used to talk about, okay, decision making. And I used to put up the old World War II staff planning process that had all these steps. And I'd say, okay, decision making technique one. Boom, and this thing would go up, and everybody would groan, ugh, right? And I said, "This is what won all those battles in the Pacific. Would you care to take the groan back?" And everybody just sat up, and I said, "So, you know, not a bad technique. Now," then I put up a crossword puzzle, not a crossword, a tic-tac-toe puzzle, right? "What's X next move?" And because everybody used to play tic-tac-toe all the time, everybody went, "Upper left corner," right? So which one do we like? We like the recognitional model. But the recognitional model overlaid into a situation where you have time to plan, you have time to get planners involved in it, is ridiculous. And, you know, the World War II model stuffed into something that's relatively short term or short fuse is as ridiculous. Neither one is good or bad. Does everybody understand that? And it took a while to knock off the way people get welded to whether it be a philosophy or a technique or whatnot. I'm curious about your thoughts on that. You sound like you've run into the same thing.
Yeah, I'd agree with everything you said there. And obviously, I'm a planner. So
right.
I love planning. So I'm probably not a fair person to ask on that exactly. But there's a time and a place for many different options. And there's certainly a time and a place where we can misapply things. You know, that, as we were talking about systemic collapse, like, you might argue that OIF won, although we applied that very well and generally crushed the Iraqi army. You know, what came out of that, we ruptured the system of the Iraqi army. What came out of that was something that was much more difficult to deal with.
And now, is that because I would say they absolutely ruptured the system, right? And again, annihilated an inferior, you know, military. And did we quote unquote attrit them enough and then they just fell apart? Was it our assault on their system? And I believe it was, we overwhelmed them with our technology and also our lethality. But when you say at the end it spawned something worse, well, is that on us? I mean, we had a Secretary of Defense who ripped up the war plan because the war plan called for, you know, 300,000 people, you know, in Iraq, or else, lest we have a civil war, and that had been war gamed, and they found that. And so is a political decision that was made that, in my opinion, gave birth and gave the space to include other political decisions. We won't honor your pensions and we're going to send the army home. Does that necessarily make the assault on their system less good?
I don't think it invalidates. I think what you're saying is 100% accurate and right. What I would say, though, is
if you keep agreeing with me, you're going to be a regular guest on the program, man. I love that stuff.
Yeah, I'm good at telling you you're right. I think there's plenty of blame to go around. How about that?
Right.
In the context of rupturing the system, you know, I think you could probably make a case, and I've heard that case made, that a more aggressive attritional approach would have certainly made a lot of Iraqis know that they'd been beaten and they'd been beaten badly. So that's one thing. I think you could also,
and with the insinuation that they would have learned that lesson and known that, additional resistance was futile and therefore no insurgency and ultimately, and maybe no civil war that busted out in the middle of the insurgency. Maybe that.
Yeah. And it's hard to prove a counterfactual. So, you know,
I'm with you, but
it is an interesting counterfactual.
No, let me tell you, I think whether you ultimately attribute it to attrition or to systemic collapse, I think the absence of enough follow-on forces to impose your will and to regulate the nation gave birth to whatever. So I think that decision, that philosophy embraced is moot because is made moot by the subsequent decision to send small numbers and think that you can take three factions in a nation and not send very many people there and it's all going to work out fine. I think that dooms the strategy no matter what.
And to your point, I mean, war fighting, although it doesn't state it directly, it suggests a lot of kind of the sort of plan that you're talking about. Small numbers, you know, you shatter the enemy cohesion and collapse the system. You don't need large forces. And, you know, it does not spend it alludes to it, but it doesn't spend very much time talking about what happens after the system shatters. And that's I think that's where we get in trouble a little bit. It may be easy to make the enemy collapse into, you know, Boyd's non-competitive centers of gravity. But that doesn't always mean that they're just going to fold like France in 1941.
Right.
Or 1940.
Right. And well, again, I mean, to me, right, phase four, right? Because ultimately we go to war to achieve the nation's aim. And if you don't have a plan for phase four, which we did not have in either Iraq and Afghanistan, which to me is absolutely, insulting word. It's absolutely unforgivable that, I mean, you're going to ask people to die, but you don't have an end state for that. And you don't, an end state that's etched in stone by an American president and blessed by, you know, the COCOMs and everybody working to that aim. We don't have that. And it's just after, you know, and you think about that in the shadow of Vietnam, you know, all those years ago. But that was the chief lesson out of Vietnam. And then we kind of reenacted it. And so, but I don't want to get bogged down on that. I want you to go into your problem. You have a nuanced problem I won't say nuance. You have a problem with mission tactics. But you don't throw them out with the bathwater. Explain, or give us the footnotes behind mission tactics and your view of them.
Yeah, so I mean, we've talked about mission tactics a little bit. We kind of danced around it a bit. I think my biggest problem with mission tactics, I have two problems, I suppose. My first problem is just it's the say-do gap that we've talked about, where, you know, we regularly tell Marines, I personally tell Marines all the time. I hope I don't mess it up as bad as some folks I've seen do it. But, you know, we tell them we are going to empower them. We're going to decentralize. We're going to ensure that they have the ability to make decisions on their own, you know, phrase it however you'd like. And then we micromanage every single aspect of their day-to-day lives. I don't know how you get around that particular problem You know, it's interesting. I just finished David Barno and Nora Bensahel's new book, and it's got a large section on exactly that. So I'm glad I'm not the only one thinking about it. But that's one problem. The second problem, though, that I run into is I think we've got a cultural problem. You know, mission tactics, as we understand them, Auftrags Taktik, mission command, whatever phrasing you want to use, grew out of a very specific kind of specific and contingent cultural environment in Germany in the late 1800s, and then obviously into World War I and then into World War II. I'm not sure that our culture has quite the same set of circumstances that will allow us to execute mission command the way we think we would like to do it.
Well, let me offer you this. I always took issue with some of the way that people articulated what their perception of mission command was, and a subordinate unit commander. First of all, if you're the senior commander's main effort, do you have any discretion? And my read of that is no. You're the instrument through which he's doing this. So he's telling you what to do. You're the main effort. You may have some nuance, but you're that effort. So you're the personification of that. Now, if you're a subordinate effort, how much discretion do you have? And so, when I was at the basic school in IOC, I mean, this debate is raging, right?
And sure.
And so I'm reading a book called Wiedemeyer Reports.
Yeah, I know Wiedemeyer Reports. I've got it on my bookshelf.
Right. And so I'm reading. And so this guy goes to the German Kriegsakademie. He speaks fluent German. And he's also, I mean, he's one of the planners of the victory plan. Mm-hmm. Which if you want to read about an interesting guy, Wiedemeyer is that guy, right? As a major, he's running the war plan for World War II. And they come pretty close to the numbers of divisions and ships and all the shit that they put out there. It's amazing. So he's an interesting guy. In the book, he references, you know, translating the German Truppenführung, the Truppenlegung manual. And mm-hmm. So I look at the footnote. And I'm like, holy shit, it's in the Library of Congress. So I go up there, I register, I get a little library card. I go say, I want to see this box of stuff. And they bring it to me. And I made a copy of it, right? And then I bring it down to IOC, and I must have killed like 80 trees, man. I made copies for all my friends. And so we're ripping through this shit, and we're arguing about, like, well, you know, Bill Lynn says this and this guy says this. And I'm like, yeah, but like, you can't do skip and go naked. The Germans are like, I've watched Hogan's Heroes, right? I've seen Colonel Hogan with his monocle. He doesn't seem like a skip and go naked guy. Now, I know he's a prison camp, the CO, and I know he's a Luftwaffe guy, right? But the Germans don't seem to be skip and go naked. I mean, that's a lot of shit to put in one direction and everybody's doing their own thing. And so I'm reading, and it says, he who fritters away the combat power of the senior commander, right, essentially does so at the peril of their own professional life. And so here's what we're telling you. If it's important, right, we expect you to act on it, okay? We also expect you to report on it. So if there's something going on there, and we've already accounted for that gap or that event, we can shut you down. So to me, I coined a term that I call coordinated initiative. Like, initiative on the battlefield will get your ass dead because people don't expect you to be there, right? And when I mean dead as fried chicken. And so if you're going to use your initiative, genius, then make sure you tell us so we can pump all of our combat power behind your genius ass, okay? Or we could shut you down if you're going on a fool's errand. Okay, so to me, when I read that in the Truppenführung, I was like, that's not the way they essentially are explaining it these days. So I don't know that a lot of people even understood the way the Germans practice it, that it wasn't skip and go naked. It was like, oh, aha, I'm over that way now. It just, in my opinion, it wasn't that way. And you hear different people explain it like that. And I'm like, you know what? I don't really go for that. So...
To kind of what you're talking about, you know, there's also an assumption there, like, if you're going to take there's enough of a common background for all of those Germans that they could kind of assume that they knew the way the other ones would react.
Right.
And that's something that we don't have. We don't have that kind of familiarity. And that's one of the things that the mission command environment really relies on is I trust you enough and I know the way you're going to react in a given situation. They had it to a large degree because of all the time they spent in the same unit, because of all the Kriegsspiels they worked through, et cetera, et cetera. We don't. The other thing I'd say to your point, you know, one of the things that we don't necessarily like to talk about a lot is if we go in a full mission command, mission tactics environment, and we say, you know, act on your own initiative, there's a huge flip side of the coin assumption of risk there. Because you may do it wrong and you may get wiped out. And you have to accept that if you're going to full decentralized, we're not communicating and telling you what to do all the time.
No, and I mean debt is bad. You don't get to come back for Thanksgiving. You know, nobody turns that shit back on. And so to me, you know, a more mature understanding of it, which is I think what you're arguing for, and an evolution for it after 30 years, to include how we define mission tactics and how we do it, I think is certainly welcome. That's why I called you up and wanted to have you on. All right, so you're critical of it. So what are your solutions to this stuff?
Yeah, and I'll freely admit that I'm not a solutions guy yet. I'm not full of perfect solutions here. For the systemic collapse piece, I think the solution is really just to again back to our conversation, to bring it into a more nuanced way of understanding. Systems collapse is a means to an end, but the end is what we're going for. So if an attritional approach does this as well, you know, if there's some other, what the Joint Pub now calls defeat mechanism, that's going to enter the mail, then maybe those defeat mechanisms are a better bet. I say we should just integrate it into the pantheon of defeat mechanisms available to us.
Okay. Let me ask you this. Does phase four get rolled into that too? I mean, is there a particular greater emphasis? Because I can imagine sitting in the OPT that is going to broaden the ground war in Afghanistan. And because I'm intellectually bent, although I didn't go to an Ivy League school, I would show up to the OPT and I'd sit in the back and then I'd put my hand up and I'd say, look, I'm not an Ivy Leaguer. I did read 15 minutes of Afghan history last night. Do we all know that we're going to attempt to create something that's never existed on the planet? Yeah. And if Germany and Japan, you know, are 60-year events post-war, this will likely be 360. Are we all on the same sheet of music? And are, most importantly, do the American people understand that so they'll give us the time to do this? Because if they don't, it's immoral for us to go ask people to die and then unask the son of a bitch in a few years when it becomes too long and too inconvenient for us. So in your view – and I know you don't have a solid, you know, yellow solution to this. Is phase four, is there more emphasis on phase four? Because clearly, you know, we fucked that up in the last two conflicts.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's certainly room for that. You know, as the services all start to move away from counterinsurgency again, you know, we're in the bottom of that sine wave as we're transitioning back towards great power competition or whatever we want to call it. I have some personal fear that we're not going to remember the lessons we've learned for phase four planning. But if you ask me, I think that's something that we definitely need to think deeply about and try to integrate into our doctrine.
No, you just made my heart sink, because that's the reason you go to war, is to win the peace. You don't go to war to, you know, to kill people and fuck up their machinery and all that kind of stuff. You go there because there's some certain end state politically that you want to get to. And if there isn't a renewed interest in that, then in my opinion, we haven't learned the lessons from Iraq and Afghanistan, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hopeful that we have learned those lessons. I'm hopeful that we'll remember the things that we messed up. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see. Anyway, so that's my solution, what little there is for the systemic collapse piece. For the mission tactics piece, I have even fewer solutions. I think really what we need to do, we need to recognize that American culture is changing. You know, we're downstream from the people we recruit, and we are in a very kind of a liminal place right now. Things are changing very quickly as we move into recruiting digital natives or having almost all digital natives in our force.
What's a digital native?
Digital native, someone who's grown up on the net internet or network connected their entire lives.
Got it. All right.
So the force is quickly becoming made up more of digital natives than anybody like you or I who learned to use computers kind of in our later years. I think that's something we need to recognize. I think it may be a bigger problem than we've realized. You know, if we have a force made entirely of digital natives who are used to being connected all the time, I'm not sure the mission tactics as we understand them is the model that we're looking for at all.
So knowing if we look at this similar to how we look at doctrine and that it's not an either or proposition, is that you've got to be able to function in both. What kind of command and control system, what kind of command and control doctrine fits, you know, the worst case scenario is you're doing something and the situation's changed and you don't have the ability to communicate and they're digital natives. So
yeah, that's a hard question.
I told you this was not going to be easy, man. Come on. Did you think that you were going to come back into the IOC Alumni Association and just get a free pass? So what do we do with these bozos, these digital bozos, man? How do we raise them? Because again, you know, some of the disturbing lessons learned is when you lean on that electronic spectrum, man, you're going to get a snoot full of rockets, you know, pretty quick.
Yeah. I mean, that is a real problem. And although at the same time, you know, you nonetheless still see it, for example, out in Ukraine, it's not like the Ukraine battlefield has gone entirely dark. They've come up with TTPs and methods to talk as the Russians are still direction finding their position and using all kinds of different geolocation drones, you name it. But you know, the Ukrainians are still talking to each other. Okay. I think that's probably something we ought to take a look at and really examine, you know, the Nagorno-Karabakh war.
So explain to us. So let's digress into tactical comms for a second. How are they talking? Are they talking the same way that the net in Hong Kong, I believe, was a Bluetooth cell phone that networked messages through that network, and they used that Bluetooth network. What do you know about how the tactical comms in the Ukraine?
You know, that's a good question. It's been a minute since I read about it. I've read a couple books, but I'm not up to date, so I wouldn't want to speculate exactly how they're doing it. The capabilities are out there. I know that. I mean, mesh networks are an emerging technology that are very hard to direction find, very hard to break into if they're used properly.
Right.
The capabilities are out there and they're kind of emerging as we speak. Are cell networks the answer? Probably not, but maybe you integrate kind of local burner cell networks into our tactical communications, because VHF radio, UHF radio, and HF radio are all kind of dangerous when you talk about, you know, direction finding in electronic warfare.
Right.
I think there's room for us to be a little more imaginative than falling back on just our green gear communications, which is something that done poorly will certainly get us killed, like you're talking about.
But as of yet, those systems are not fielded, right? And so,
not to my knowledge, no.
Got it. All right. So bottom line is, MCDP-1 needs to be updated, needs to be revised. Would you say? MCDP 1.1, do you see the need for it to be MCDP 2? How much revision does it need to be completely rekeyed?
You know, I think it would be useful to really go back and take a look at it. And I remember, gosh, when I was a command staff, so maybe 5 years ago, 6 years ago, whenever it was, I had a conversation. John Schmidt came into one of our classes and we had a conversation about MCDP-1 and he was advocating pretty aggressively for a revision.
Well, just so you know, all those guys, they were iconoclasts themselves. So to me, they would look at the fact that it hasn't been revised in 30 years and go and say, what the fuck are you guys doing, man? Zinni, right? He didn't do anything like anybody else did. One of the things I learned about Zinni is that he would say, yeah, the Australian peel, right? I don't like it. I don't like the way the Australians do it. I like the way, like, the Indians do it. And he would tell you this different thing, like, and but I don't like that 100%. I like that 70%. And then I do this, and I combine this technique with this. I mean, and these guys were all, you know, and this is going to freak people out when I hear it. But what they were was that, because Marines aren't supposed to be artistic, creative people, okay? We're supposed to be rote, shaved head monkeys, okay? but what you meet when you meet these kind of guys are these creative people. They're these creative geniuses, and they tend to be involved in systems, but they're at their core, they're creative people. They're really smart, creative people. And so I think that as a chorus, they would all say, rewrite the son of a bitch, right? Assault it, rip it apart, find out its strengths and weaknesses. Because if somebody believes that ripping apart the system is the yellow, then we've got a problem, because there are no yellows in our world. And yeah, so
I think that's probably right.
Yeah. No.
And you know, General Krulak wrote it in his foreword. I just opened it up to the front page where he says we must continue to revise our doctrine. It's not a reference manual. We have to keep right. updating it. It's been 30 years since we've done any sort of substantial update, and 30 years plus the small update in the late 90s, 97. I got to think that now in 2020 there's room for smart folks to really think about it, not throw the baby out with the bathwater, but to bring in some of the things that I hope we've learned in the last 20 years.
And then with the idea of reducing the gapos, because the gapos is between say do. Yes.
My personal opinion is the say do gap is terrible at any time. But particularly with the kind of the disintermediation that comes with social media and the ability for people to just, you know, talk to each other and throw their opinions out there. I think a say-do gap now really puts the Marine Corps in a very bad position. And it's really corrosive to good order and discipline.
Yeah. I do a thing, a mental health thing about living with trauma, and essentially, I call it flat black traumatic wisdom, but it's things I learned, most of it from Marines, enlisted type, from the rank of sergeant and below, who've taught me a ton of stuff. And this thing is very popular, and it works relative to how to live a great life with trauma. And I call it blue collar mental health, but really what I do is there's a gap between the reality of what a PhD sees and the reality of what a Lance Corporal lives and sees. And they're not. And the reason we have the destructive behavior numbers we have inside the DOD is because of that gap. I mean, they don't talk well. They don't converse well with each other. And so I would be all about it, man. I think that it needs to be plain spoken English, and those concepts have to be what we do. And, you know, to me, the do-say gap, there are times when we are going to be able to, because of electronics, be able to support you better, give you more guidance. And then there's another part of the spectrum, which means you may be, you know, you may have to act, you know, in a cold environment. When I say cold, I mean electronically cold, in which, you know, you don't have calm. But you do see something, and you know you have to act. And it's not an either-or proposition. There's a spectrum, and you've got to know where you're at in that spectrum, and you've got to know what's important. And so I don't know that, as you say, you know, the maneuver warfare doctrine adopted that John Schmidt wrote about, I think, was a fantastic doctrine for the Wehrmacht in, you know, the late 30s and into World War II. And it suited them culturally. And I think the Marine Corps, you know, the next step would be, I think what you're arguing is the Marine Corps got to make it ours. It's got to be more like Marines. It's got to be more nuanced and tailored to our technology and the way we actually do fight, reducing that say-do gap. And if we could do that, then we make it become actually more of our doctrine, because that what drives us and what we do on a daily basis, because it does account for reality and take into affect the way we operate. So when are you going to write that article? When are you doing that? When are you going to get after that?
I'm getting there slowly. It's bubbling, you know. I'm thinking about it. How about that?
I think
there are smart people are out there, and I'm hoping that smart people are coming up with the answers to the questions that this conversation poses.
Right.
I think you're exactly right, though, that it doesn't matter how good MCDP-1 is, and MCDP-1 is fantastic. It's well written. It's convincing. Everything in it makes sense. But if we don't do what it says, then it just doesn't matter.
Right. And if somebody, and again, my thing is that, like, if you met the people that wrote it, they would, if they were not, they'd rip it up right now too. And I don't mean rip it up. They would scrutinize it, rip it apart, ask questions and say, yeah, you know what? People don't understand this and they don't understand this. And the C-do gap is too big on that. All right. So let's go back to school and let's do that. They were iconoclastic people in and of themselves, and they wanted to produce a document that worked more than anything else. And so to me, you know, now that you and your punk ass headline, man, now it's on you to write the solution.
that's exactly what my wife told me when I wrote the article.
Yeah, no, if you illustrate the problem. Well, I mean, you illustrate the problem, but it's a punk ass headline, though. It's like, all right, dude, you better solve this shit or we're going to like drag you through the street. So there you have it. You have something to do this weekend. All right. What's the next thing you're going to write?
I got a couple that I'm thinking about. Nothing that's ready for prime time yet. But
well, I heard, by the by, that you're going to have something else published here soon. So you've already written something.
Yeah, it's in an article about the Pentomic Division. Actually, it was on the Marine Corps Gazette website. And I don't know if they're going to put it in the magazine or not, but it was on the website last month.
And what's it called?
It's called the Pentomic Division, A Cautionary Tale. So the Pentomic Division was the Army's reorganization in the 50s for nuclear war or nuclear warfare. And they made a big mess of it. And so I kind of wrote about it as, you know, the 50s were an interesting time, much like now is an interesting time. And as we're reorganizing the Pentomic Division, something good to keep an eye on and learn from their mistakes.
What was their glaring mistake? Since the Marine Corps is in the middle of probably one of the greatest reorganizations, certainly in my lifetime, what is the seminal lesson from the Potomac Division?
Pentomic Division. Pentomic. So, you know, what the Army did was they kind of made a lot of changes all at once without thinking through, without getting a lot of feedback or buy-in from the force, and they made a lot of kind of. A lot of guesses about future tech that didn't pan out or just didn't work out. So, you know, this is a time in societal, cultural history, whatever you want to say, where lots of things are changing all at once, and it would be easy for us to make those kind of same mistakes. So it's a useful cautionary tale.
All right. We'll leave it at that. I want to get the, no, I mean, I don't understand. I understand the pivot to the Pacific. This is just my official statement. I don't have official statements, but the shit I say on this show, I don't understand why the entire Marine Corps that, you know, the fight in Korea is vastly different from the fight in the South China Sea. The fight in Africa or in Europe is vastly different from either one of those two. I don't understand why the Marine Corps is going to be in one likeness. And so, and I've always been a student of institutional change and how that happens and the amount those changes get debated and the buy-in of the force and things like that. So very timely. Where do we find it? On the Gazette's website?
Yeah, it is on the Marine Corps Gazette website and web articles from September, I think.
Got it.
Yeah, it would have been September. It's called the Pentomic Division, A Cautionary Tale. And yeah, I'm not sure if they're going to put it in the magazine. There was some early talk of that.
All right. All right. Well, first of all, Tad, always a pleasure to meet part of the IOC alumni, which is one of the coolest alumni groups you can ever be a part of.
One of the best.
Yeah, exactly. But I really enjoyed the piece. Made me think, and looking forward to your solution someday. And thank you very much for doing this.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a great time.
All right. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.